I'm Jim Haskell, editor of the Bridgewater Daily Observations, and I'm here with my partner, as always, Jake Davidson. And Jake, we have a pretty special podcast today.
That's right. We have another installment of our Inside the Research Engine series, and we are welcoming Daniel Yergin to the program today.
Dan is one of the most respected authorities on all that is energy. He's the author of multiple books, and probably the one that gets the most attention is called The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power, for which he won a Pulitzer Prize. But he has a new book out called The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations, which we link in this observations. One of our strategists, Adil Lele, is friendly with Dan, and he basically made it happen where he invited Dan to one of our research meetings. And so what you're about to hear is an edited version of a great conversation between Dan and Adil, but also including two members of our commodities team, Andrew Foote and Elena Gonzalez-Molloy, as well as Karen Carniel-Tambor, who's, of course, the co-CIO of our sustainability team. So with that, let me turn to you, Jake, just to cover what were the main topics covered in this discussion.
Yeah, it's a great discussion, and it's a long conversation, but it's really rich. And it has three broad sections, and we'll mark those in the podcast player so that you can easily skip between them. The first section is Dan giving his thoughts on the green energy transition. He talks through why the move away from fossil fuels is likely to be a lot bumpier than previous energy transitions, and probably bumpier than maybe a lot of people expect. And then the second topic they discuss is the current state of the oil market and fossil fuel market. What's going on with shale, the role of OPEC Plus, and the impact of the move of many investors to divest from fossil fuels and the forward-looking impacts that could have. And then finally, Dan wraps it up talking with Adil about the geopolitics of energy, the relationship between Europe and Russia, Russia and China, and how the green energy transition may shake up who the power players in energy are.
So let's get right to the podcast. It starts with a question from Adil on the energy transition.
Hey, Dan, great speaking with you again. And thanks so much for joining our research group today. So getting right into it, in your book, you note that energy transitions are not new and they've been going on for a long time and they unfold over time. Now, previous transitions that we've discussed have been driven by technology, economics, environmental considerations, convenience, ease. But the current one has politics, policy, and activism mixed in. And so in certain ways, in my mind, that makes it easier to transition because it's more premeditated. But in other ways, I can imagine it being more difficult because it goes beyond what's economically rational, at least in the very short term. And it's also going to be subject to the major ideological issues that come up whenever politics is involved. So anyway, Dan, that's all to say that we're interested in your thoughts on whether this makes the transition that we're seeing today easier or harder than previous transitions.
Thank you, Adil. And I'm very pleased to be here with you and your colleagues and to have the chance to also address the Bridgewater community. I think it makes it more difficult. You know, I date the beginning of the energy transition was January 1709, when an English metalworker figured out you could make iron better using coal than wood. But these unfolded over a really long time. And really, up till now, the energy transitions have really been, for the most part, energy additions. Case in point, oil discovered in 1859. Oil overtakes coal as the world's number one energy source in the 1960s. And I checked this the other day. The world uses about almost three times as much coal today as it did in the 1960s. So this is a whole different thing. This is out with the existing and in with the new. And the other thing is that it is meant to happen in a very short time. You're talking about a $86 trillion world economy that might be $185 trillion in 2050 and completely changing the energy base in 28 years. And by the way, after Glasgow, a lot of that's supposed to be done in the next 8 years. Never been done before. It's a big deal.
Hi, Dan. This is Andrew Foote. I'm a member of our commodities team. It's great to have you here. As you know really well, we've seen broad-based rise in energy prices. Everything from crude oil to coal to natural gas price has been rising sharply. The conventional wisdom is firming up this price strength as a collection of temporary short-term drivers. For example, the geopolitical tension between Russia and West Europe, the safety rules in China that have been suppressing the production of coal. But will this shortage of supply and the resulting high prices really be temporary in nature when it's just, it's not just one geography or one specific commodity. So is it right to look at the landscape today and see this market pricing as being driven by events that are temporary in nature?
Well, I think that's a really big question, Andrew, because it was right. I mean, this unfolded on the doorstep of Glasgow, and it was kind of brushed aside. If it's a one-off event, then the world will go by it. But I'm beginning to think it's not a one-off event. And by the way, let's call it what it is. In Europe and China, it's an energy crisis. It's not an energy crisis in the United States. But, you know, you've described rationing electricity, factories shutting down, spot LNG prices as much as 7 times higher than normal. This is an energy crisis. And governments, they're kind of trying to paper it over by giving money to consumers and so forth. And as you say, there are a lot of factors that have come to work here. But I think what basically happened is shortages. Shortages of coal, because there's been underinvestment in coal. LNG, then for being to backfill. And then, by the way, wind speeds being inadequate in the North Sea, which generates a lot of the electricity for Britain and Northern Europe. All those things happening kind of at the same time. When you had the Chinese economy in overdrive in COVID and coming out of COVID, so strong economy, strong rebound, and you just ran up against tight supplies. And then we can get into why oil, I mean, this is different than other energy crises because normally oil is the leader. Here, oil is the follower of this. But I think that there's a reasonable chance that we're seeing what I've started to call preemptive underinvestment in conventional resources, and that we could well have a series of shocks, as some have said, some prominent economists have said, particularly as you try and push 2050 goals into 2030 and choke off investment in what still provides 80% of the world economy's energy. So I think this is more than just a passing thing. And if it is recurrent, then that's going to also create backlashes and difficulties and of all sorts. I mean, you hear, is the U.S. going to intervene and stop exporting energy and so forth? I mean, we'll come back and talk about the importance of shale and all of this. But I think this is, you know, my guess is this: if we have decent, good economic growth, this is not a one-off, that this could well be a recurrent pattern. And policymakers are not thinking about that.
It sounds like you're saying, Dan, that even if some of these events are temporary, idiosyncratic, that there's a set of frictions and tensions that are much more structural and enduring.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, obviously, it's a lot of different things coming together. You know, you have you lose some supply temporarily in the Gulf of Mexico. Usually when things happen, it's not because of one thing. But, you know, you've got to look at the balance between capacity and demand and supply. And, you know, this is tightening, and the pressure is to continue to restrict. One of the things, I did a dialogue with the vice president of Nigeria, and he was railing against the European banks that won't lend them to build, you know, gas in Nigeria, which they think they need for poverty reduction. So access to investment is going to be tougher. And so why I say preemptive, the timing is off.
So given this discussion, I think this might be a good point to actually bring in Karen, who's our co-CIO of sustainability, because obviously there's some major ESG issues at play here.
Hi, Dan. This is Karen. Thank you again so much for joining. You know, when we think about what we hear discussions from the angle of people talking about the energy transition, we find that a lot of the conversations focus on just how fast will transition happen, what will the temperature be, and not on the mechanism, like what are the cause-effect relationships that you're saying will lead to the transition. And I would love to get your reaction to this, because we've sort of laid out 4 different cause-effect pathways, mechanisms that we think are the most primary ones, if you will, that could happen, with the first one being the main one that seems to currently be going on. One thing you can do is you can try to just restrict supply, and you get the transition from making supply go away. You can either mandate it at the government level, or just like you're saying with this Nigeria example, you can have banks say, well, we're just not going to lend. It was just going to be impossible to get financing. And you just choke off the natural supply growth. You could do it that way it might not work because there's so many people that could still come in and create supply once the prices are high, and it could be highly inflationary. That feels like what we're living through today. And then what we've pointed out is it seems like there are a lot of other ways to transition, not talking about speed and effectiveness. You could make the demand go away by making it expensive. So that's the tax carbon, you know, kind of approach.
Which
you
could politicians never want to do.
Of course not. Well, actually, we thought what happened in this environment is that you would get kind of the subsidies route, what we've called monetary policy three, where you say, you know, if we're printing money anyway, why don't we print money and then run fiscal policy to just subsidize like crazy anything green, make it so cheap. And just like China has already done with getting a successful solar and getting EVs sort of going, let's just subsidize it like crazy. That's sort of path three, like you're saying, less painful. Politicians hate taxing things. Nicer to just subsidize the good stuff. And then the fourth, something people don't talk about that much, but you've been in the center of, is this question of, could you have a breakthrough technology that just makes some of these other paths so much cheaper that the transition happens in a very economic
way? Which is, by the way, which is Atul was talking about historically, that's what happened. You had improvements in technology.
Exactly. So I would love to get your thoughts on, are these the right four paths? Well, do you agree with us that the main thing going on right now is the supply choke? And where do you see this sort of going?
Yeah, I think supply choke is a good way to describe it. I'm on the, I'm the only kind of non-Indian on the energy think tank for the Indian government. And one of the things that I've found very interesting talking to them is they say it's not an energy transition, it's an energy transitions, plural, because they have other imperatives. They have, you know, the World Health Organization has said huge environmental problem is indoor air pollution. So they wanted, they're building a $60 billion natural gas system. They're sending propane to villagers so they don't burn wood and dung and so forth. And so I see, you know, a subset here, maybe it's called, there's a potential of a new north-south divide along these things. So, but when they say energy transition, they say it's plural. So I think your subsidy route is, that's the path of least resistance for governments. You know, we'll give you how much, whatever amount of money you want to buy an electric car. You know, that's the way to do it. Of course, electric cars are 20% plastic. And I think the other things, I mean, I think your four tracks is a very powerful way and a clarifying way to see it. I mean, the things I see that are difficulties, one is this north-south divide. I mean, you just hear it again and again. And it's not listened to. You know, the North just says there is only one existential question. And the South says, oh, by the way, we have other existential questions that are very immediate. The second is what we talk about is shocks. The third thing is the supply chains for this whole thing. You know, what are the net zero, the new supply chains for net zero? I mean, these are immense things that have to be created. And in the new map, I say, do we go from an era of big oil to big shovels to do it? So I think that's an impediment on, and I'm just not sure which of your scenarios it fits into. It would be supply shocks, both because you're cutting off conventional and you suddenly have everybody rising to the other side of the boat. So I think you're quite right that the glib use of the term energy transitions makes it sound like something that is so well lubricated that you just slide through it rather than saying, as we were talking about, this is a really big thing to change the energy foundations of, you know, a global economy, and to try and do it in, you know, with proclamations and do it in 28 years and assuming that it's going to go smoothly.
I wanted to circle back a little bit to this kind of this intellectual tension that's kind of playing out in the media and in markets about the extent to which these challenges are temporary versus more enduring. And I think in your work, there's a great appreciation, and you transmit really well for the grand historical scope that we've seen transitions before. And I'm thinking of a comment you said where since 1880, there's been five cycles in the oil market where there's been this giant pendulum, and at one extreme, the understanding is that energy or oil is ample and cheap and easy to find. And over time, you swing away from that to another extreme where there's this realization that actually it's a finite resource and it's hard to find. So should we be looking at the way things have unfolded over the last year as being another
example of that broad historical scope, and we're actually seeing.
Well, I think but with new things that go back to what Karen was talking about, which is the choking off of finance. You know, before the remember this commodity super cycle in the first decade of this century. On the eve of that, companies were told that they needed capital discipline and not to spend, and that oil would be $20 forever, and that was the new normal. And capital was constrained, and then you got the super cycle. I'm not saying we're going to have a super cycle again, because I think there are other factors at work, but you know, depends how you define a super cycle. But we are in a period where capital is constrained, and if you have demand growing, then you get that pendulum goes on. I mean, that's what struck me when I looked back at the prize when people were talking about peak oil a little more than a decade ago. I looked and said, oh, this has happened before. In fact, it's the same vocabulary. So there are these recurrent economic patterns. Now, one thing to go back to what Karen said, the fourth path that she mentioned was technology. And of course, that is the big question here, because you're going to see so much poured into technology. And you know, the IEA has supposedly said that half the technologies you need don't exist yet, or at least on scale. And technologies do take time, as opposed to different from software. I mean, the lithium ion battery was invented in an Exxon laboratory in 1976, and the first Teslas rolled out in 2008 commercially. But you know, hydrogen, if you'd mentioned hydrogen 3 or 4 years ago, you know, the room would have cleared out. And now Europe is talking about getting 25% of its energy from hydrogen in 2050. That's going to depend upon technology. That's going to depend upon bringing the cost of electrolyzers down or other things. And so maybe technology is the black box that we can't see into right now. But even technology takes time.
Speaking of technology, another really important point you make is how a lot of the so-called quote-unquote bad oil companies may actually be the best placed players to do some of the transformation work because of their expertise.
You know, it's interesting. At Glasgow, the oil companies were not allowed to participate. But who's in the energy business? Who has the engineering skills? Who has the scale? Who knows how to execute projects of this nature? And this all involves heavy engineering. Well, among the companies at the forefront of this are the oil companies. That's what they are, is they're engineering companies to a large extent. It's not going to be done by people who make, you know, consumer products or something. It's engineering. So they have to be part of it. And I think all of, you know, I'd say that the major oil companies, they're all looking to various degrees at carbon capture, which when you do your numbers, even our really aggressive green rules where governments go all out and sort of maybe one of your four paths, you're still using, you know, over 50 million barrels of oil in 2050.
Why is it that we're somewhat leapfrogging nuclear power to go to hydrogen? Is it because of Chernobyl and more recently Fukushima, or is there some other reason?
Well, I think that Chernobyl and then Fukushima. I mean, Chancellor Merkel in Germany was a big booster of nuclear power until Fukushima, and more or less on that weekend afterwards made the decision to take Germany off nuclear power. And there, you know, so in the first half of this year, Germany generated more electricity from coal than it did from wind. But I think the other reason is that build these plants in places like the United States, they end up being 3 or 4 times more expensive. They take much longer. Permitting is a recurrent problem. Execution is a problem. And not just in the United States, in Europe too. So the country that's moving ahead most aggressively on nuclear is China, which builds them more quickly and more cheaply. But I think that nuclear, I mean, when I was researching a new map, I was surprised to find like 45, now I think it's up to 60 companies and research institutes in the US are focused on next generation, more advanced nuclear, and modular nuclear power plants are something that's much discussed. But it, you know, if you look at the EU, they're not putting much emphasis. And yet nuclear in the United States is the largest single source of carbon-free electricity.
Great. So, Dan, we've talked about green energy. I want to shift topics here and get your thoughts on where things stand with traditional energy sources like oil and gas. And to do that, I'd like to bring in Elena for this discussion.
Hi, Dan. This is Elena. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about what you called preemptive underinvestment, and particularly in regards to oil, because now it seems like there's a chance that oil supply might actually peak before oil demand does. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, the view that I have based upon, you know, looking at it carefully is that oil demand continues to grow for the next, you know, roughly 10, 12 years before it starts to slide down. But as I think your point is, aggressive government policies clearly have an impact. I mean, it's interesting as we're now seeing this great concern in the United States about gasoline prices because we're in that time. And it's striking, you know, the administration is saying, OPEC plus, please increase production, but they're really not talking at all, it seems, to the domestic oil industry. And yet you would not know from the dialogue that actually President Biden is the president of the country that's the world's largest oil producer.
And I think that's a really great segue into one of the pieces that we wanted to discuss today, which is U.S. shale. So since the low point in prices last April, we've seen a really sharp recovery in demand, a slow producer response from both OPEC and U.S. shale, which has maintained supply below consumption, leading to inventory draws and driving prices up. And as you've sort of discussed, one of the biggest changes in this oil market has been the shift in U.S. shale behavior. Could you expand a little bit on this change and whether or not you view this as sustainable?
I think it's so interesting to me that, I mean, the shale revolution is really a big deal, not just in terms of oil supply, but in terms of energy security, in terms of the economy. I was playing around with the numbers yesterday. If we were back importing what we had were importing in 2008, we'd probably be spending $300 or $400 billion a year importing oil, and you know, a couple of years of that, and you have an infrastructure bill. It's a lot of money, and it's changed politics in ways that are, you know, global politics, which we could come back to. But there'd never been anything like the shale growth anywhere in the history of the oil industry in terms of the scale and the speed. And you had 7 or 8 U.S. presidents saying we want energy independence. It seemed impossible to get there. And then we got there. And now it's just kind of taken for granted. I was in a meeting a little while ago with a moderate Democratic senator who said we have to right-size our policy to the Mideast. He wouldn't be saying that if the U.S. was importing 60% of its oil. It has really brought energy security. You can have big things that would have sent the price of oil shooting up, like drone attacks on a huge oil facility in Saudi Arabia, and the price doesn't move. So it is very significant. But I think what you're saying that there was one price collapse, and the second one that, of course, came with COVID, and prices actually became negative, which, you know, you had to wrap your mind around. People had to pay people to take oil away because they couldn't move it. Storage was so filled. And now it's really turned around. It turned out people were sort of saying benedictions on U.S. shale, but in fact, it's proved to be quite a resilient industry. There's been consolidation, greater efficiency, and took to calling the second shale revolution, which was a change in the relationship between the producers and investors, because the investors said, hey, you can have great growth, but we'd actually like some money back. So there's been a very big focus on capital discipline. Now, I saw a headline in one of our newspapers saying energy producers, you know, are holding back supplies. Well, that's kind of the flip side. They haven't been rushing in. And by the way, you don't make big decisions based upon what's happened to oil prices over a period of 6 week period. You have the private producers who have really stepped on the gas, so to speak. And I think we're starting to see the public companies are going to, you know, start to step up activity. And in fact, we're looking next year at an increase of about 800,000 barrels a day in oil production from the U.S. Now, 300,000 of that is coming from the offshore. 500,000 is coming from shale. So it's not, you know, they're not going crazy, but they are going to respond to prices. And at the same time, they have to maintain their kind of their new social contract with investors.
Yes, and I think this really points out the need for U.S. shale to resume its role as the marginal producer, particularly as we see over the next year, OPEC Plus returning their barrels to the market and driving that spare capacity down towards historical lows. How do you see the focus on capital discipline and shareholder returns changing U.S. shale's ability to be that marginal producer?
I think you've gone to kind of a very important factor, which the U.S. became the dominant. The reactivity of U.S. shale was the dominant dynamic in the oil industry, is what you're pointing to. And now it's kind of shifted to OPEC Plus. If U.S. production starts up again, then that balance changes again. And I think, you know, people will respond to price signals. But at the other, they're also in a regulatory environment that has gotten tougher with the new administration. You know, this administration doesn't talk about, unlike all the previous administrations, doesn't talk about energy independence as a positive attribute. And so there's still the question about the regulatory or the administrative aspect of it. But, you know, I think if we get 800,000 barrels a day increase next year, or, you know, goes higher, then it does start to change the balance. And, you know, you've gone that question of spare capacity, as it's called, barrels that are, that's in OPEC Plus, particularly in the Gulf countries, that's a very important stabilizer market. And if that shrinks and it's not made up elsewhere, you get a tight market and you get price spikes from it.
You have a great analogy where you say that OPEC's role is sort of to be the Federal Reserve of the oil market. Could you expand a little bit on that?
You know, I use that advisedly, but they sometimes characterize themselves as the central bank. I mean, you know, it was totally chaotic last spring, the spring of 2020, price war between Saudi Arabia and Russia as the world was going into lockdown. And I think out of that, they constructed this thing called OPEC Plus, which had actually existed before, but it had fallen apart, which is informal, but it's really led by, there's a big three in world oil. There's number one, the United States, number two and number three, Saudi Arabia and Russia. And number two and number three gotten together and said, kind of manage the supply to stabilize it. And if we have oversupply, we'll have the price collapse again. And, you know, they're looking at saying, is there going to be oversupply in 2022? Don't know. It depends on the world economy. Also, it's a hard deal for them to manage. I think there are 23 countries involved, that if you start changing the formula, the whole thing could fall apart and you could have prices both go down and then spike again. So they're trying, you know, they have this 400,000 barrel a day deal that they're bringing back into the market. But going back to preemptive underinvestment, some of the OPEC and non-OPEC countries can't actually even meet their quotas because of lack of investment. That's been lack of maintenance in their systems, and they're not even able to attain that level. But, you know, they're pretty much saying that they're going to stick to their 400,000 barrels a day. And if they do stick to it, then eventually, you know, you won't have any spare capacity.
I think there are two good follow-ups from what you're saying. So one is to reconcile this framework of OPEC as the Fed with thinking of U.S. shale as the marginal supplier. And then what I heard from you in terms of the problems with maintenance and some of the OPEC producers not even being able to meet their quota is an interesting connection with the fact that we've seen extremely high compliance across OPEC Plus members. I think just in September, you've seen over 110%. So what would you use to explain that?
I would say part of it is that some of the countries just can't meet their production. And I think some of it is fear of God, you know, that if they don't hold it together, then the whole thing falls apart. Now, one other thing to keep in mind about the oil industry, like everywhere else, at least in the U.S. economy, you have a labor shortage. You don't actually have the people to go back and really step things up. People have left the industry or, you know, or got discouraged, so forth. And the same pervasive shortage of labor that's affecting our ports and trucking retail establishments and everything, is also affecting the oil and gas industry, that there's a constraint on an input called people.
That makes sense. And then diving into Russia in particular, you've typically seen them almost be a free rider in some of these OPEC plus agreements. And now you're seeing a trend towards them being highly compliant with the rest.
I think, let me jump in there, because I don't think they've been a free rider. I think that really the heart of the whole deal is the relationship between Russia and Saudi Arabia. And that, by the way, when you get into geopolitics, you know, has something to do with Putin's overall strategies. But they talk to each other, they talk about each other now as strategic partners. And this didn't happen overnight. There was a lot of animosity and suspicion between the two, but, you know, kind of common interest has brought them together. Although, I mean, I think Putin has said oil prices are too high right now. And, you know, and I think they're also aware, these countries, if prices go up, you're going to damage demand anyway. And we'll go back to current scenarios. Governments will pour more money into subsidizing electric cars. So, you know, they don't want to lose markets. And the Russians in particular, and I know that from personal experience, having been shouted at by Vladimir Putin on this very subject, the Russians, they don't particularly want to see U.S. shale come back, because they see the U.S. gas, of course, LNG is a competitor with their gas in Europe. And they see, maybe more clearly than many people in Washington see, that the shale revolution and the change in the position of the United States increases U.S. influence, gives a new dimension of U.S. influence. Again, I see that in India, where the fact that the U.S. exports energy to India is a really important element in this much improved relationship between the two countries. Prime Minister Modi said it, the ministers have said it, and I think that, you know, not understood so much here in the United States, but it's well understood in Moscow.
In light of all the things we've discussed, how is OPEC thinking about their role of managing the oil market, considering the energy transition that's underway and the potential for peak oil demand?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm going to be at the conference in the Gulf in just a couple of days, and I think I'll hear a lot about it. I think that the Gulf countries are the key ones, are increasing their production capacity because they see capacity investment going down elsewhere. They see international companies saying, we're going to reduce our investment in exploration. So I think they see themselves as gaining market share during this period, and that there still will be, you know, a substantial oil market for some time to come.
You know, as it relates to, we've kind of run this thought experiment, which obviously is extreme and this won't happen, right? But imagine, for the sake of argument, that all of the moral suasion, you know, kind of worked and every single private sector developed world player just decided, like, we're going to phase out oil, like we're going to stop doing it. But everybody who's a national player, you know, all the kind of usual suspects, does not have this, you know, moment. They still have their, I mean, they have to fund their own budget deficits. So they don't decide to just stop, you know, doing oil. I even put places like Norway in that category because it's literally funding the government deficit. Obviously, it would be disruptive. But, you know, how much would oil consumption actually come down once you had a little bit of time to adjust and those players kind of realize the boom they're about to have and the fact that they're the only players in town from not? Will you actually, you know, achieve massively fewer barrels of oil used a day and you'd move to green and achieve your climate goals? To what extent could those players ramp up, given there's just such a big part of the supply is held by players like that that aren't really susceptible to sort of private sector shareholders and their resolutions and views?
I mean, you've probably done it, run the numbers to see how much you would lose, how much you would gain, how much you would get run down. But, you know, the pressures in the publicly owned companies are very great and likely to grow greater with new regulations coming from the Securities and Exchange Commission, what the Europeans are doing, and the pressure on the reviews or the requirements for portfolios by institutional investors. The beneficiaries of that would be the national oil companies, because the demand is still there. There are 280 million cars in the United States, and even as we see electric cars become more common, Most of them run on oil, and the average car in the United States stays on the road at least 12 years. So, you know, unless the government's going to buy everybody's car and give them an electric car. And by the way, when lithium demand increases 4,300% and cobalt 2,500% and ESG criteria start to be applied to those minerals and sourcing too, things will get even more complicated.
Yeah, it's an excellent transition to talking briefly about ESG. You know, from our perspective, at the time when people were sort of saying, well, don't worry, ESG is exactly the same as my financial returns, we were kind of looking at it and saying, well, then there's nothing really new under the sun, right? Because your goal is always to make money for investors. And if you think the way to make money for investors is to think about environmental or social issues, people are always paying you as a money manager to make money for investors and whatever you thought was meaningful and important. And people said, well, I'm worried about risks. People always paid people like us to manage risk. The thing that feels like a revolution to us is that more and more people who manage money are saying, you know, yeah, I have to care about returns. I'm not saying I care differently. I have to make the highest return relative to risk. But in addition to that, I feel like part of my mandate is to contribute in some way to this environmental transition. And so you have trillions of dollars saying, I'm going to align with net zero. That's now a commitment that is binding, that is multi-decade, that you have people you hire to figure that out and you have to align your whole portfolio. That's a really big change. That's a really fundamental change in investing.
And I guess, and it's possible that regulatory authorities, financial regulatory store, will actually create some real distortions in the economy and difficulties by limiting capital. I mean, up until a few months ago, it was actually okay to say, well, my ESG objectives correlate with my financial return objectives. But now, you know, I think you guys would know much better if some investors say, well, actually, we do need returns. And by the way, it looks like we can get returns from this sector that we kind of have turned our back on. But we're still going to have ESG. We're going to still have the regulatory authorities. We're going to have some share of our own clients who object to it. Kind of, what do we do? And so I think from the company's point of view, energy companies, they're trying to say, well, we're going to have 2050 goals too. We're going to do technology and so forth. And that will be, you know, we can show you what we're doing. That will be persuasive to some investors, but not others. And there is a risk that you'll have regulators in Europe and in the United States, who really don't understand the energy system, making rules, financial regulators turn into climate regulators when it's not really their lane and they don't realize what the consequences will be.
I want to move away from oil just for a second, Dan, and ask you a question about natural gas.
Our colleagues here in the Investment Engine had a discussion about onshoring and the prospects for a larger share of manufacturing to move away from Asia back to North America. You make a point I don't think is widely appreciated, and that's that natural gas is a fuel, it's a source of heat, but it's also the building block molecule for many, many basic and intermediate goods. You know, you don't make ammonia and plastics without natural gas as a feedstock. I'm just wondering what you think about that. If the U.S. having some of the world's lowest cost deposits of natural gas is critical to this whole discussion of onshoring. Would we even be talking about onshoring if it weren't for shale gas? And I was wondering if you could, you know, more broadly expand on the basic dynamic between the availability of energy and how supply chains get structured.
Well, I guess I sort of think that we're, and going back to another book called The Commanding Heights, that we're probably in about 3 decades of this modern globalization era in which you got these really complex supply chains. And a lot of them were driven, of course, by the availability of cheap labor. And then sort of a little over a decade ago, the U.S. started to have something, a competitive advantage over other countries in terms of cheap energy. And I think that's what you're getting at, the cheap natural gas. And I think the number is there's something over $200 billion of investment that's gone into factories in the United States in the last decade and a half because of cheap natural gas. And so that is, I guess as people think through their supply chains, that's an attribute to have access to cheap, reliable energy is a real advantage. I mean, clearly reshoring is going on, or maybe we just call it in a sense shoring, because let's say the batteries for cars, I mean, China now dominates 80% of the lithium ion battery supply chain. But of course, you have Ford and GM in partnership with SK and LG building battery factories in the United States to bring them closer. The Biden administration has basically done a document where they're calling for that.
Okay, so at this point, I'd like to pivot from the issue of reshoring to something which is related, which is the geopolitics of energy. So when I think about it, for most of the past century, geopolitical power has been really intimately connected with fossil fuels. And that's obviously still true today. And we've touched on some of the sources of leverage and the vulnerability that this creates in other parts of this conversation. And so one area I'd really love to ask you about in more detail is the energy tensions we're seeing today between Russia and Europe.
If you look at Europe's, call it their domestic energy production, natural gas production, it's down about 17 or 18% in the last 4 years. So they have had a vacuum. Then the EU has been kind of going through this debate, this searching debate. Do we regard natural gas as something that should be in our energy mix, should not be in our energy mix? And suddenly they wake up. And of course, natural gas is a very big part of their overall energy economy. It's tight and prices are going up. They say, oh my gosh, we should have had long-term contracts, et cetera. We didn't do anything to encourage the Russians to invest in new capacity for that. And we're tight of supply and we're competing with China for LNG supplies. You know, Russia right now is, you know, Putin has said that he didn't like having Russia described as an energy superpower. He said that some years ago because it sounds too cold warish, but kind of they are right now because it's oil, gas, and coal. And they're, I think, the largest supplier of coal now to Europe too. So, Europe is really quite dependent upon Russia for energy. I've always thought the notion that this gives Russia some unique political leverage overstated. And one of the things I did in the new map is just went back and looked at the 1960s when there was an issue in the 1980s, the beginning of the century, and now. I'm not sure what they really mean by that it gains leverage from it. It certainly gains market influence and revenues from it. But I think the Russians feel, you know, they've been sort of berated. Obviously, they want to get this Nord Stream 2 pipeline accepted and in place. But, you know, even if that pipeline wasn't built, Europe will still depend very heavily on Russia for natural gas. But it's a two-way street because Russia buys stuff from Europe, too. So I've never believed that, you know, that they can kind of, they'll control the supply and Europe, the European countries will say, we want to quit NATO or something like that. I think that part has been overstated, but certainly, you know, right now, Russia is an exporter of energy to Europe. This is a really good time and place to be there.
Yeah. So getting back to Russia and now thinking about the relationship between Russia and China, and you've noted this in the new map, Russia's made this pivot to the east. And back in 2014, in May, there was the deal between Russia and China, $400 billion deal over 30 years. And that included China financing $45 billion of the Power of Siberia pipeline. Now, back in 2005, 5% of Russia's oil exports went to China. Today, it's 30%, and Russia's eclipsed Saudi Arabia as China's number one supplier. And so how do you see that evolving?
Well, I think that I was at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum, maybe it was 2 or 3 years ago, and Putin's guest was Xi Jinping. And Putin began by apologizing to Xi Jinping. He said, I kept you up talking till 4 a.m. your time. And Xi Jinping said, oh, that's okay. We never have enough time to talk. These guys have met dozens and dozens of times. And I think many things bring them together. To one degree, I like to say that a relationship that used to be based on Marx and Lenin is based on oil and gas. So I think that's part of the relationship. But I think they are united together in being very resistant or seeing themselves opposed to what they see, in their view, as a U.S.-dominated international order. And they've only gotten closer. You noted that date of the spring of 2014. That was just after the annexation of Crimea. And so it was really important for Putin to get a really big deal with China, and he got it. And that relationship continues to grow. And as you know, in the new map, I have this photograph, this picture of Putin and Xi Jinping together making Russian pancakes together. And at the same time they were doing that, the Chinese and the Russians were having joint military exercises together. So they were cooking more than pancakes. They were kind of cooking up this this even stronger strategic relationship. And so obviously there are big differences between the two countries, but I think there's a lot between economics, between energy and geopolitics that pulls them together. And they're both led by people who were going to be in power for a long time and see it in their interest to be together. And so it's part of this kind of polarization we're seeing in the world.
So I think that's a really great segue into the next area, which is that the world seems to be splitting into these diffuse energy clusters. And so my question here is, going forward, who do you see as being the big energy clusters?
At this point, of course, you see that, China is very well positioned. 80% roughly of the world's solar panels come from China, and they have the incredible cost advantage. When I started my previous book, The Quest, I talked to the head of the German solar panel photovoltaic company, which was the largest in the world. By the time I finished the book, he was bankrupt because the Chinese had just taken the market. And in a sense, Europe subsidized the development of the Chinese solar industry. And look where they are in electric cars. Half the world's electric cars are there as well. What I see is, this gets a larger question. What I hear, and I'm sure you guys hear from the same thing, whether it's Southeast Asia, whether it's Africa, Middle East, Latin America, countries saying we don't want to choose between the United States and China. And for the Middle Eastern countries, China is their major market for their export of oil. Number one market, the US isn't a market. And so I think you see a lot of countries, and Xi Jinping in his last speech at Davos said, remember, we have the largest growing market in the world. You want to be here. So I see that as a factor that countries not wanting to be, and even the Europeans don't want to be, have to choose sides in what seems to be this growing division.
And so on China and thinking about it, its transition, even though you've warned us earlier not to use the word transition because it makes it all sound very smooth, China's made this big bet to go green, and it's widely acknowledged that they're probably the best position to emerge as the world's renewable energy superpower. Now, it enjoys a clear lead in green manufacturing and patents and provides 85% of the world's rare earths and has two-thirds of the global supply of scarce minerals and materials required for part of this transition. It also has a huge reliance on fossil fuels. And so this is something that we've been tracking fairly closely as a part of our China research and our sustainability research efforts. Some of these policy choices that China's making, especially around the transition to a greener future, seem to be exacerbating the energy price rises in China that we've seen, particularly so over the last couple of months. Others, such as the electricity pricing policy, which involves fixing electricity prices, seem to be leading to the very acute price spikes. Do you see any chance of either of the policy goals being adjusted in China, either those relating to electricity prices
I think that the Chinese, you have to say, what's the hierarchy? What are the hierarchy of imperatives? And the hierarchy of imperatives for the Chinese right at the top is maintaining economic growth and delivering, every year the sort of the promise. And so I think you've sort of seen that tension in China between sort of the environmental advocates and those focused on growth saying, well, wait, let's not rush. How fast do we rush or not rush? And obviously you deal with the short term. So China had limits on coal production. Well, they're 10% above those limits now because they have said, okay, we need to produce more coal because we're not going to deny hospitals heat. We're not going to deny, our factories need to continue to employ people. And so I think that they'll adjust, but I think the trend is certainly there. And, I've always been very interested, and I write in a section of the book about, Roadmap to the Future, about China's commitment to the electric car was not just because of climate. It's because of their concern strategically about importing 75% of their oil. And if they continue to be by far the world's largest new car market, they'll just use more oil. And that gets into the South China Sea issue for them and strategic vulnerabilities, something that's been part of the Chinese thinking since the Korean War. And they also, it has to do with urban pollution. And then the third thing is the recognition that they were not going to be able to compete with the internal combustion cars of the Europeans, of the Americans, the Japanese and Koreans, but they can leapfrog on EVs. And now Chinese EVs are starting to appear in showrooms in Europe. And they see that, you know, they could perhaps become a very fearsome competitor in global EVs. And so I think a lot of different factors go into the decisions that they're making.
Okay, Dan, I've got one more question for you, and it's purposely really complex and really open-ended. And that is that the world's always been defined by this asymmetric nature of the fossil fuel ecosystem, where the world was divided into exporters and importers of energy based on what they've got in the ground, what their natural endowments are. Now, those natural endowments are highly concentrated, but the renewable ecosystem is far more dispersed, and that implies a shift to a less oligopolistic energy market. So here's the question for you. How do you think that's going to change the energy map going forward?
Well, I think there will be the focus, as we were talking before, I think most with your colleagues, that where minerals are will be very important, because you're going to need so much more minerals. And will that take on political significance, or will it just be markets? You know, time will tell. But if you have an energy system that is less dependent on, you know, supply chains of oil and more self-sufficient, regionalization, nationalization, localization, I think that takes that kind of stress out of the system. I think it's not been 100 years that suppliers have had that grip. I think it's been about 50 years since the 1970s that it really became a contentious issue. Remember, until after World War II, in World War II, the US provided 6 out of 7 barrels of oil that the Allies used. It was a very different balance. So I think, you know, a decentralized electricity system that's more renewable certainly takes some of the geopolitics out of energy. You know, I think have to think through other dimensions, because of course it isn't just the wind and the sun that you're depending upon, but there's a lot of materials that go into that to make that happen. You know, you can see India now saying, we don't want to import solar panels from China. We want to build up our own Indian industry for that. But can you do it and be competitive? Because the Chinese have such competitive advantage in that. But it is, I think what you're saying is that the old traditional geopolitics of oil and gas would recede, but then the new geopolitics of net zero would come into bear in ways that maybe we can't yet quite formulate what they would look like.
Thank you so much for joining us. Hopefully we can have you back and continue the discussion at some point in the future.
Well, we can certainly be sure of one thing: the world will continue to change. And I think the next couple of years are going to be have stresses that people haven't anticipated. So there'll certainly be things that we'll need to continue the discussion. So I want to thank you and all your colleagues for a very stimulating and a very interesting conversation.